Good evening.
I'm Kilo 2, Romeo, India Whiskey. Trying to get it right tonight. My name is Dick. You'll also hear Mel, K2, Kilo, Echo, Yankee. Mel and Dick together run something called the Technical Net. We try to organize this fairly enthusiastic, slightly crazy crew that really wants to study their favorite subject, ham radio, and learn a little bit more about it. They help each other. There's an awful lot of brain power in the New York City area. We tap into it, or we attempt to. We assemble the this meeting of the clan, as I sometimes call it, the clan of ham radio operators, who gather to discuss whatever subject comes up that they feel like asking a question on or making a comment on. So the subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are supplied primarily by the listeners and participants. Mel and I only rarely suggest a particular subject. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in if you're just listening. After 28 years, we sort of accept that somebody must be listening. It wouldn't have lasted this long, and we're all kind of surprised that it did. Already signed in is N2EO, a carryover from last week, and N2XJN, who's running a set of fairly deep experiments into some science study. Anyone else would like to check into the Technical Net, please give me your call letters, name, and that word yes at this time. K2RIW.
K2KIF. My name is John. Yes.
K2WYP. Skyler. Yes.
W2MIT. Gary. Yes.
Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
Okay, so far we've got John, Skyler, and Gary. John, do I have your call letters correct? Kilo 2, Kilo, India, Foxtrot. Over to you, John.
Affirmative.
Yes. Very fine. Okay, and one of the things we're going to probably have to do that Eric's going to be suggesting to us is after you hear the beep, wait a second or two, which I haven't done yet. Alrighty. As I said, we've got Rich, Wesley, John, Skyler, and Gary so far. Anyone else to check into the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters, name, and the word yes right now.
With a short space report.
Okay, Mel and Paul with a small space report. Mel, did you have something that you wanted to say first before we begin? Over to you, Mel.
No, nothing in particular, Dick. I think we'll just continue as we were doing it last week. It seems to be successful. Try to keep them within reason so we can cover all the called-in questions. Over.
We'll make an attempt. Okay. Rich, a carryover from last week. Are you available? N2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW. I hear the sound of microphonics being tested. Somebody's tapping on a rig. Or if that's you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm just looking for loose connections.
Yeah, I hear the tapping. Very interesting sound. Alrighty, Wesley, what's the latest in the laboratory in Queens? N2 X-ray Juliet November, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. This is N2XJN. Am I coming good?
As they say in Poland, you're coming good. Please continue.
Okay. Well, I was having a very interesting conversation with a number of the key people on this repeater, and I would like to bring to the attention of ham radio operators some things they've read that are not very much discussed, but they are essential to understand how the coils work, how the magnetic field is being created, and all other properties. The simple experiment that was provided that actually regards to eddy current and Lenz's law. Well, you take the copper pipe and you put a magnet in it, and you drop the magnet. No. You take the same magnet and you take the plastic pipe and you drop the magnet. What you see is that in the plastic pipe there's a free falling regular way, and in the copper pipe it takes several seconds, sometimes 3, sometimes 15 seconds before the magnet is dropped. Depends from the thickness of the pipe and or the strength of the magnet. And it is being created because of the eddy current. And I have found very interesting phenomenon in this. Steady drop. While the magnet is falling down, there is a vertical vertical magnetic pull that actually crosses the walls of the pipe from that falling magnet. Then, at 90 degrees to that magnetic vertical pull, creating circles, you have the eddy current. And let's say the magnetic field is clockwise, then eddy current will be clockwise. But then this eddy current goes through the walls of the pipe, of that copper pipe. And then you have secondary magnetic field created by the eddy current, which actually extends from the walls. And my question to you is, would it be possible to, at first, for you to explain how this phenomenon works? I have sent you also the video. And a second, if let's say we put the core of the ferrite pipe inside that copper pipe, would then the secondary eddy current, no, I'm sorry, the secondary magnetic pull that comes from the eddy current, that is horizontal, and is extending the walls, be able to activate the ferrite particles of that inner pipe? Back to you.
Reasonably complicated question, and I'm going to start off with the basics and may not get all the way to what you're asking, but it's safe to say that of all the things that electronic engineers and ham radio operators in general study, electrostatic fields is a little bit more understood than electromagnetic fields. Magnetic fields and how a transformer works in particular gives the average electronic engineer quite a bit of grief. The way it's taught is far from the best way. The books don't make it as clear as they could. I had a lot of trouble with it for some time until I started winding some of my own transformers. And through the hard school of knocks, I sort of found out what didn't work, and eventually some of the whys. Let me start off with Faraday's law and Lenz's law. In the case of Faraday's law, I could start off with a coil of wire. It could have one turn, it could have 40 turns, but it's a flat coil of wire, and the two ends of that coil are hooked to some kind of conventional meter, sometimes called a Dawson Bell movement. But if I had a milliammeter with a zero center type milliammeter across that coil, and then I took a bar magnet and plunged it through the coil, as the magnet enters the coil, I'll see the milliammeter deflect to the right, some number of milliamps flows. I stop moving the magnet, the meter will come back to zero. I retract the magnet back out the same way I pushed it in, and now the meter will move to the left. Negative current will flow during that motion. So from that you can conclude that whenever a change in magnetic field occurs inside of something that is a closed loop of conductor, voltages and currents are induced by the movement of a magnetic field. And you'll notice it sort of happens at right angles. The coil, will say, is flat on the table, so to speak, but I've waited.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The coil started off flat against the table, but I raised it up without changing its orientation above the table, and I took this magnet and plunged it vertically through the center of the coil. So I'm moving the magnetic vertically, but at right angles to that moving magnetic field, the coil is picking up a horizontal current, a circumferential current. If I did something a little bit differently, if instead of putting a meter there, I put a dead short circuit, and then a dead open circuit. When there was an open circuit, I would notice that the magnet is easy to exert into the coil. When there's a dead short circuit across the coil, I'll notice that as I attempt to move the magnet, I feel a certain amount of resistance. I could do it with a carefully balanced spring scale, and I would find out that the magnet acts sluggish. In other words, the coil of wire is picking up a voltage or a current when the magnetic field moves. The presence of the magnetic field, the presence of the current creates a counter kind of magnetic field, which opposes the motion of the magnet. So because energy was attempting to be conveyed from the moving magnetic field into the coil, because of the energy being picked up by the coil wasn't being dissipated in a conventional manner, going through a reasonable resistance, going through a meter or whatever, going into a dead short circuit, the normal voltage drop across the coil wasn't able to take place. A higher than normal current flows. The current in turn creates something that many professors will call a counter-EMF. The counter-EMF is in such a polarity that it opposes the motion of the magnet. The magnet now will sense resistance. You will have to push harder to make it move through the coil at the same rate. Once you see the principle of that, make believe now that you've got a copper pipe. Let me drop. And somewhere halfway down the copper pipe, I take my magic marker and I draw a blue circle around the perimeter of the pipe halfway down. That's a circumferential circle. In other words, the circle I'm drawing is normal to the axis of the pipe. And that circle that I've drawn on the copper pipe, I call that a closed circuit coil of wire, one-term coil. And as I attempt to push the magnet through the copper pipe, I will sense the resistance similar to what happened with the coil of wire in the previous experiment. Well, you can tell right away that I'm very naive to write with my magic marker just one single circle around the perimeter of the pipe at one z-axis location. Along the length of the pipe, there's a million of those circles, and every one of them is doing the same Lenz's law, Faraday law type phenomena, and therefore the currents that are induced into the circumferential currents that are induced in the copper pipe by the movement of that bar magnet strongly resist the motion of the magnet, and therefore you could carefully time how long it takes for the magnet to drop through a copper pipe, an aluminum pipe, a cardboard pipe. You'll notice that through the cardboard pipe, the magnet drops at essentially the free fall of gravity, so to speak. Through the aluminum pipe, it'll drop a whole lot slower. Through the copper pipe, it'll drop a whole lot slower yet, because the copper has higher conductivity. It is inducing a greater amount of Lenz's law phenomena, this opposing EMF. One of the classic cases in the old world, before you had modern-day microprocessor-controlled instrument panels on a car, every one of our automobiles had a speedometer, and if you took apart the speedometer of, say, a 1970 automobile, let me drop, you would find out that the so-called speedometer cable connected to either the transmission or the differential somewhere along the drivetrain, there is a worm gear, and the speedometer cable is connected there so that when the car is moving forward and the driven wheels are rotating, the speedometer cable consists of a center conductor and an outer sheath, and the center conductor is being rotated. And that speedometer cable is a flexible thing. It comes up to the back of the instrument panel, and where that speedometer cable connects to the inside of the instrument panel, it is rotating a small bar magnet, rotating it at right angles to the rotation of the center conductor of the speedometer cable. Around that bar magnet is an aluminum cup, and that aluminum cup is connected to a spring. The spring, in turn, is connected to a pointer. The pointer comes up to the instrument panel, and that indicates miles per hour. As the car moves more rapidly, by way of the speedometer cable, the small magnet behind the instrument panel was rotated more rapidly. That, in turn, created a greater amount of Lenz's law force that was a coupling force that was trying to rotate that aluminum cup, but it's being resisted by a spring, and that moved the pointer, and the pointer moved upscale and told you you're moving 50 miles an hour, so to speak. So there was a beautiful example of Lenz's law in a real physical object, making a real measurement, which has some similarity to the magnets being dropped through the pipe. Part of the reason why Leslie is studying these phenomena, let me drop, is that these very strong modern magnets you can get a hold of, made out of neodymium and other compounds, but there's a compound of neodymium which is capable of giving you a small fixed magnet of not very big size, which has an extremely strong magnetic field. You can have an awful lot of fun taking any one of the hard drives that somebody throws into the garbage anywhere in your company, your block or whatever. When somebody throws away a hard drive, if you're willing to take it apart, by the time you get to the innards, you're going to find two extremely strong neodymium magnets, and they're a lot of fun to play with. Be a little bit careful. You can get yourself in trouble with them, but some very strong magnets are inside of almost every single conventional hard drive before they started coming up with the modern-day solid-state ones. Well, you start using these very strong local magnets in modern-day motor generator-like things. And depending on how you make the measurement, a significant number of people in a lot of countries have made movies, and they're selling hardware, and they're selling plans and whatever for machines that appear to be operating at greater than 100% efficiency. You could, for instance, be applying, let's say, 100 watts of power to rotate a motor. And connected to that shaft of the motor is a kind of a generator. And the generator, and all of these motors and generators are running with these neodymium magnets, the generator could be generating more than 100 watts of output if you believed everything that you see verbatim that's on these YouTube videos, and there's a lot of them. And so lots of investigations are beginning as to explain what is happening, why it appears to act this way. It's a fascinating subject. A naive person will say, hey, that sounds like perpetual motion. I'm not going to go there. I'm not even going to think about it. You guys are crazy. Well, stand by now. A carefully made set of measurements by a guy who's got enough engineering smarts to know what he's... Enough engineering smarts to know what he's doing with reasonably good instrumentation, but calibration that's ultimately traceable.
You didn't wait long enough.
Roger. Okay, hopefully we've reset the machine. So, you shouldn't immediately take a negative attitude. You'd be amazed how many good pieces of science were done for what looked like a crazy original premise or original hypothesis. And in the process of investigating the hypothesis, even though the desired result may not have been realized, as long as you don't throw out any of what you think is bad data, if you try to explain it all, so to speak, and don't become subjective, as long as you're objective when you make the measurements, knowledge will take place. There's a lot more unknown than known in the world. No matter what area you feel like investigating, if you do a good enough job, I guarantee you're going to find something that somebody else has missed for a lot of years, and it's worth pursuing, as long as you're doing objective science. There is no such thing as bad science. There's science that's done badly by people who lie. You know, they have such a strong opinion they're going to get such a particular result that they only look for the evidence of that result and throw away every other little nugget of evidence for any other potential result and report it that way. Well, that's a very foolish thing to do, because on a peer-reviewed journal, like, say, for instance, Science Magazine, the journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, you publish an article in there. First of all, getting it accepted is not easy, but getting an article there where in reality you've made some huge errors in both judgment and measurement procedures, people are going to come down on you pretty hard real fast when they find out that if they try to duplicate your experiment in their laboratory and don't get your results, and they find out that you've been fudging the data, and your reputation can go down the tubes real fast. So that's the only kind of really bad science. But other than that, measurements that are made for any purpose, as long as it's not hurting people in the process, can be, in my opinion, darn good science. I throw that out because various people discussing these subjects are...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
various people discussing these subjects on this and other nets, on this and other repeaters, have sometimes ended up saying derogatory things to each other, and that's not fair, as I see it. Good ham radio operators don't do that. So, I think we've got a little bit of an explanation for why a magnet drops slowly through a conducting surface, anything that's got a ring of conducting material. Now, let's go one step further with this and show you something that I'm worrying about. If a person was doing an experiment where he decided to subject a human being to extremely strong magnetic fields, you've got to be a little bit careful, because the ring of conducting material could be a saline solution, could be the plasma that's in a bloodstream. If you subjected your cranium of your head to an extremely strong magnetic field, because the perimeter of your head consists of conductive fluids, you could induce currents and voltages in your head by rapidly changing a strong magnetic field, whether it be a cyclic field coming from a 60-cycle transformer, or whether it be an extremely strong magnet, and you decide, a steady-state magnet, a permanent magnet, and you decide to stick your head into it. Depending on the rate at which your head moves through that very strong magnet, you could be inducing significant eddy currents through the perimeter of the conducting materials in your head. On a very minor situation, you might develop psychedelic effects. On a major, if you move your head more rapidly than that, and if the magnet's any stronger than that, you might be giving yourself electroshock therapy. And being done under an uncontrolled condition, the process could be damaging. I do remember reading an article about a guy who did subject himself by rapidly putting his head inside of an extremely strong magnet, and as I remember the...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
As I remember, that particular man doing that experiment possibly did not survive the incident. So be a little bit careful. When, for instance, you put yourself through an extremely strong magnetic field for good diagnostic purposes by putting yourself into a MRI machine, magnetic resonance imaging machine, which does operate with a very strong magnet, you'll notice they put you on a table that very slowly moves you into that magnet. By the same token, you're supposed to come out of there very slowly. You come out of there rapidly, and you could get some rather peculiar effects. And it's not worth experimenting with, if you know what I mean. So, what really is a magnetic field? When you get two magnets, toroidal-shaped magnets that are magnetized in the axial manner, and you stack them onto a plastic rod, such that two north poles repose at each other, and one magnet is suspended in the air versus the other. It's an experiment that we've often done. We've often seen it. Let me drop. So we might have a significant amount of experience of what happens, but why does it happen? What really is that magnetic field that's doing that repulsion? And the upper magnet is being suspended in the air for a long period of time. Significant discussions have taken place on this repeater, among other places, as to whether or not energy is being dissipated over the, let's say, 1 month period that magnet is being suspended in the air by the lower magnet. Is it dissipating energy? Is there an available kinetic or potential energy being demonstrated? Are there ways of tapping into this by which you can come up with a machine that appears to operate at more than 100% efficiency? Lots and lots of questions to be questions and answered here, as you can see. I know I didn't get down quite to what you're discussing, Wesley, but still, maybe the listeners have a little bit more of an understanding as to what is the eddy current of a magnet dropping through something like a piece of copper tubing. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Quick comment, KC2WGV.
Go ahead, John.
That exact experiment with the copper pipe was performed by Eric when he got home. He was so interested in it, and I believe you'd like to hear his description of the effects he observed. So I'll stand by and listen. Thank you.
Good suggestion. Eric, if you're available, go right ahead.
I'm not in a position right now, Dick. Sorry.
Okay, we'll delay that a little bit later. This day usually lasts for 4 hours, so we'll have time. Wesley, back to you. I know we didn't get deep enough into your subject, but I do think there's a darn much misunderstanding. as to what is Faraday's law, what is Lenz's law, what are eddy currents. And to throw in one more comment here, you take apart any of the 60-cycle transformers you've ever used, you'll notice the core of the transformer is not one solid chunk of steel. It's made out of a whole lot of little plates, laminate. It's a whole lot of sheets of individual iron-like material. And the reason for the individual sheets, and the thinner the better, or maybe made out of ferrite particles, is to limit the amount of area inside of one of these Faraday loops, Lenz's law loops, to try to eliminate the cross-sectional area of the material that is potentially capable of supporting eddy currents. So by careful mechanical design, you can drastically limit, never completely eliminate, but drastically limit the magnitude of eddy currents, because in many circumstances, eddy currents are undesirable. They're desirable when it comes to that speedometer on an old-fashioned automobile, but in many cases, they're undesirable, and they waste energy, make the core hot, and make your transformer less efficient. So understanding them and controlling them has a lot of benefit, and therefore it's something worthwhile learning about. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. Well, at first I would like to thank you, Eric, for his contribution to checking this phenomenon, and all others, including Lou and John and plenty of others, who were actually taking their own time to discuss this issue. Now, so let's say we have a magnet inside the copper pipe. The pipe is vertically. Then we have vertical circles from the center of that magnet. These circles represent the magnetic field. Because of this magnetic field cross-sectioning the walls of the pipe, we have at 90 degrees to these circles, inside the walls of that copper pipe, we have the eddy current. And the eddy current is actually going also clockwise as the magnetic field. What is the eddy current doing is actually tapping the walls of the pipe and slowing down. But then we have another effect. Because of the eddy current, we have at 90 degrees to that eddy current that is also vertical, inside the wall we have a horizontal secondary magnetic field because of eddy current. Now this field extends the walls of the copper. Let me drop. And there is a kind of interference between the vertical magnetic pull from the magnet by itself and the horizontal magnetic pull that is secondary to the eddy current. Now, I asked myself a few questions first, that if I put inside that copper pipe the toroidal pipe made from ferrite, then the secondary magnetic field will actually activate at least part, the other part of that ferrite core. But at the same time, I asked myself another question. What could be done to slow down even more that magnet? And then I came to the conclusion. Another experiment. You take the U-shaped magnet, you take the magnet from the speaker, and you take the closed loop of the copper wire that actually fits on this magnet. Well, what's happening is, when that coil is closed loop, the coil is slowing down. It's not totally pulling. So then I ask myself, what could be done to slow down that motion? And I came to another conclusion. You said that induction, increase of the induction because of the copper makes the change towards the aluminum pipe. So, slowing down the movement of the magnet or the copper wind that actually goes to the magnet will actually deliver the extra energy to that, will actually make this magnet to fall very slowly or even reverse if you input too much of energy. So, if the induction factor takes the place and it's important, then we may say that the air by itself at 30 kilovolts is actually the air breaking factor, which means that the air is ionizing at that point. So, delivering enough of energy, we can create anti-gravity. The anti-gravity will not actually not come from for free, but it will be available. And actually, there was a various numbers of ion engines that are not only working in space, but they are working in here, in air. They were actually provided, and I can provide the examples of this investigation if it's possible. Now, do you understand what I'm driving to? Back to you, Dick.
I think I do. Let me add a couple of more words that are slightly off to one side, but I think it's going to help. If I have a bar magnet, and I set it vertically on the table, so it's the majority of the magnet, its axis is perpendicular to the table, and I do a bunch of study with iron filings and Hall effect probes and whatever, and I eventually figure out where the magnetic field from that bar magnet is, and you called it a circular field, and I agree with that. If the north pole of the magnet is up, I'll see primarily lines of magnetic field coming out of the north magnetic pole, eventually curving around the outside of the magnet, somewhat like the longitude lines on a globe, and then re-entering the south end of the magnet. I could study the magnetic field around a bar magnet. I then could slip a piece of copper tubing over that bar magnet and let everything settle down and do the study again. I will find the exact same magnetic field in the places that I have access to. In other words, the presence of the copper tubing, because it's a non-magnetic material, in the steady state, has no effect on the magnetic field of the bar magnet. Now we can use that to our advantage. We know that when the magnet tries to move through the copper pipe, each of the circles of copper in that copper pipe represent a closed circle coil. The movement of the magnet through it is creating a changing magnetic field in each one of those equivalent one-turn loops of the copper pipe. That in turn creates a current. The current in turn creates a counter magnetic field. And if I studied the magnetic field, that would be a difficult one because it's a dynamic situation. I would find out that the eddy current in the pipe is inducing a vertical magnetic field, and the part of it that I care about.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And the part that I care about most is inside the pipe. I will find out that the counter EMF, by way of Lenz's law, in that copper pipe, that's created when the magnet is dropping through the copper pipe, that the eddy current, so to speak, in the copper pipe are creating a magnetic field that is vertical inside the copper pipe, and it has such a polarity that it looks like it's trying to suck the magnet upward, so to speak. So it would have the same kind of a magnetic field as if I was putting another magnet above the first one, and north was aimed towards south, and I'm trying to suck upward the magnet that's in the center of the copper pipe. That's what the counter EMF would be doing. Once you understand that, we can now have a very interesting experiment. I could have a fairly long piece of copper pipe. Let me pick a number, 12 inches long, and maybe the copper pipe is half an inch in diameter. And maybe my bar magnet is coming close to a half inch of diameter, so it drops through the center of the copper pipe with a very small amount of extra airspace in there. Now, I could, if I want to, wind a very long solenoid coil on the outside of the copper pipe. I make the solenoid coil considerably longer than the length of the magnet. Let me drop. And again, remember that a steady state magnetic field has no effect on the copper pipe, or vice versa, the copper pipe has no effect on the steady state magnetic field. So with this very long solenoid winding on the outside of the copper pipe, I pour some current through it. The current that I'm pouring through that coil creates a vertical magnetic field in the center of the copper pipe. If I adjust the strength of that magnetic field by way of adjusting the current in the coil, I can come up with a situation where I am almost, but not quite, levitating the magnet. I can make the polarity of the electromagnet I've just created such that it is attempting to push the bar magnet vertically. But I made it a little bit too weak where it doesn't quite suspend the bar magnet. So I've got a bar magnet that now acts as if it has almost no gravity, very, very little. And now when I drop that bar magnet through that piece of tubing, and make believe I've made this the solenoid coil out of the right kind of... I first formed it on a piece of cardboard tubing, which was hardened with some kind of epoxy or whatever, so it doesn't change shape. I have the ability to put down the center of the solenoid coil, an aluminum pipe, a copper pipe, or a cardboard pipe. If I put a cardboard pipe through there, and the solenoid coil was not connected to anything, the magnet would drop in a normal manner. Put the aluminum pipe, it'll drop at a certain rate. Put the copper pipe, it drops at a slower rate. Now I start pouring current through that solenoid coil, and I re-measure the drop rates. I can make all of those drop rates, all three of them, much, much slower, because I'm creating another magnetic field, steady-state magnetic field, that is almost, but not quite, suspending the bar magnet. And by the way, let me drop a... This is one of the crazy things I could be doing with this.
I can respond to that, too.
If I made that solenoid magnetic field very, very strong by putting a pulse of high voltage to it, that magnetic, that bar magnet in the center of this solenoid, if I was using a cardboard tube, so I could develop the magnetic field in the center very rapidly, I would now have a magnetic cannon. I could move that bar magnet that close to the velocity of a firearm, if you know what I mean. So you don't want to overdo this. But by carefully adjusting the strength of that electromagnet field, I could almost suspend the magnet, and I could make it drop so slowly that it drops at a very easy to measure rate with the cardboard tube. It drops at a much slower but easy to measure rate with the aluminum tube, and with the copper tube, it'll drop so slow that it might take 10 minutes to get through there, if you know what I mean. So you can artificially create this suspending magnetic field, steady-state magnetic field, with the solenoid on the outside of your tubing, whatever kind of tubing it is. It would be a very interesting set of experiments. Now, you've done something similar to this, Eric, and you probably have comments on what I just said. KE2EJ. Wait for the beep. KQRIW in the TechNet.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. First, let me say that my first reaction to this was absolutely completely wrong. Okay, because I was thinking, well, this is a dead short. And if you want to look at it from a ring and molecular level of copper, okay, this is a dead short, and you're not going to induce a reverse field. And later on, after I did my little experiment, you know, I did some more reading, but when before I came across it, it was like, oh, you know, I forgot about that. Okay, but here's the interesting thing that I found. I used a piece of plumbing, okay, just as a control, I used a plastic pipe, and dropped a molybdenum magnet. It was almost like not the same size as the inner diameter, but a little bit smaller, but it was a flop. You know, you drop it, and it falls at the rate of gravity. I used a copper pipe, drawn copper pipe, which is hardened, and actually I found, after doing a little more research, that they actually add a couple of elements to what we call water pipe, too. Not only is it tempered into a hardened state, but it's actually slightly alloyed. We call it copper pipe. It's not really copper. It's pure copper. It has nickel and stuff like that. When you drop it down that way, it takes time. It kind of goes clunk, 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 because the magnet really doesn't fit. You know, it's a little small in size, but it's at a slower rate. Then I ran into a piece of real pure copper, which actually was part of a tank circuit. It was very straight, and it has no impurities. It's very soft. It's malleable. You can, you know, squeeze it and bend it literally. And the magnet drops through that considerably faster than the drawn copper pipe. That kind of made me scratch my head, and that's after that, I told John, a repeater.
Time out. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Where'd you lose me?
About 25 seconds back.
Okay, so I found this really pure copper pipe that has no impurities in it. And the magnet dropped through it considerably faster than the drawn water pipe. And I mean considerably faster. And I kind of wanted to attribute that to some ferromagnetic properties of the hardened copper pipe that we use for water pipes. But after a while, after talking to telling John what I found, telling Wesley really quickly, I didn't really get into the conversation with him because we didn't really have the time at that point. I did a little more reading, checking out physics, and ran across Lenz's law and a few other things. And that reminded me of something that I built many, many years ago, which is sort of like the reverse of that, which is a coil with a bunch of laminate, and you can put an aluminum ring over it and suspend it in the air. And that's kind of what I found, and that the fact that the pure copper pipe was faster kind of made me scratch my head. So that's what I found there.
Okay, there's a beautiful experiment you can do, which is the next step, Eric, and you're enough of a scientist that if you had the time, I know someday you might want to do it. Assuming, first of all, that your soft copper pipe and your hard-drawn plumbing-type pipe have the exact same inner and outer diameter, same wall thickness, and same overall diameter. A bunch of assumptions there, but if they really are physically identical but just different in composition, the next step is to confirm a hypothesis that I've got, and that is, if I had superconducting pipe and I tried dropping a magnet through it, the magnet would not move at all. The conductivity,
liquid nitrogen
will lower the resistivity of your copper. Therefore, an experiment you can do is how much slower does it drop. But the conductivity of the copper and whether or not it's superconducting makes a huge difference as to the rate at which it will allow a magnetic field to change because of the back EMF being generated by way of Lenz's law. Therefore, it is my belief that even though you thought the soft copper would be better in resistance than the hard drawn, you can rapidly find out, and that is do a so-called Kelvin experiment of resistivity. Take the identical length of the two kinds of pipe. Again, you have to make the assumption you've got the same inner and outer diameter, same wall thickness. And pour, let me pick a number, 10 amperes of current along the axis of the copper pipe. Then with a second set of contacts, Kelvin contacts, measure the millivolts of drop across the copper. And you'll be measuring milliohms and microohms of resistance from one end of the copper to the other. My hypothesis is that your beautiful soft copper really had higher resistivity, and that explains why the magnet dropped more rapidly through there. Another experiment to do with, that you and Wesley could do is that even though you have a single piece of copper pipe and the magnet drops through at a certain rate, if you take a slightly larger diameter copper pipe, put it outside of the first one, so that now that there are two concentric copper pipes, so the magnetic field crossing the first one has to then cross the second one. Again, it is my belief you're going to see a magnet drop more slowly. That combined with the solenoid experiment could give you some beautiful science. And putting ferrite materials in here, with reference to the rate of drop of the magnet, I think the ferrite materials are going to have only a second order effect, because by definition, ferrite materials really don't support these eddy currents that are really the phenomena being mentioned, or measured. Let me turn it over to you, Eric, on this one. Do you think you have the ability to measure the milliohms of your...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Measure the milliohms of your two kinds of copper pipe. Do you think you have the ability to do that sometime later when the smoke clears and you've got some time to do these crazy experiments? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the DECnet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Eric, first, go ahead.
I think I have a 1939 general radio Wheatstone bridge with mill-ohm references to work with. Yeah, I've used that thing many times. But that's a very cool idea. I like
like that. I'm going to try that. Yeah. I'll make some time for that. You know, in between all the other stupid stuff that I'm doing, I have to set it up right so I can, you know, really document it and do it the right way. But that's a wonderful idea, Dick. And you know, while I'm at, have you ever seen the aluminum ring suspension gizmo? You know, it was the novelty item of the, I think, of the 70s or the 60s or 70s. You know, it was one of those popular electronic little projects. It was very cool.
I think I did, but I'm not sure. Now, what I'm about to do is go over to Glenn for a comment. We're rapidly approaching 9 o'clock. I'm then going to be asking John for his permission to go over to Skyler. Skyler, I believe, is a guy going to school. He probably has a curfew. Therefore, we ought to pick him up before he has to go to bed, and we'll go in that order. So, Glenn first. KC2QIQ, go right ahead with your comment. Then we're going to temporarily skip over the subject and come back to it in about an hour after answering other people's questions within the so-called 9 o'clock period. KC2QIQ, you got it, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody else on the net tonight. Just my comment tonight is just about magnets and also, you know, permanent magnets and magnet materials like the ferrite, where ferrite basically is magnetically neutral unless, there, of course, there's some kind of an electrical field around it, a coil that's energized. And where I have a lot of experience in this area is that is building special inductors. You can take ferrite, which generally, if you just have no air gap in it, in a toroid, and you put a winding around it, put a DC offset current, basically the current will saturate the H field very, very quickly, unless you have a distributed air gap. So many times what we can do, let me let it drop for a second, is one of the things we can do to extend the inductor so that we can allow it to put a DC current in, is we put an air gap in between. But another little investigated fact that not too many people know about is you can fill up that air gap with a magnet, a polarized magnet, and now you can put an offset into that BH curve. So basically, as you want, you fill up the air gap now with a permanent magnet and basically wind the coil around the outside, and now you have a polarized inductor so that you can actually hold off a much higher B and H field inside that inductor with higher DC currents and hold a much higher inductance stick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
That's very crafty. So if I've got a circuit where I want that to be an inductor, and simultaneously, a significant inductor, simultaneously, the inductor might be a smoothing choke of a power supply, a real current is flowing through it that is tending to saturate the magnetic core, and I can counteract that saturation by putting a steady state magnet of the opposite polarity in that gap. Very crafty. Is that something that was invented in your particular company, Glenn, for a quick break? Over to you, Glenn.
It's something that, yes, and the University of Paderborn, Germany, Dick.
Don Clever, those Germans.
I heard we're coming.
Okay, yeah. Make it brief, Wesley, because we're going to be going to other people and coming back to you. Go ahead, Wesley.
I just want to add the taste and the flavor to the discussion come back to it, is that what I was trying to understand is, because the magnetic field doesn't have to come from the magnet or falling magnet by itself, how is it possible that I was able to burn 2.7 using the 2.7 watts, the burn light bulb of 150 watts, so I'm gonna make the point at this area after we come back to it. And the second thing is that this kind of proceeding in this discussion leads us to Ioncraft, which is the ion engine, but that one operates on the Earth. And to XJN, thank you very much, and back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that ion engine is capable of some extremely strong efficiency with reference to propulsion engines. Skyler, I am guessing that you might be a person going to school. As such, you might have a curfew. I'm going to first pass it to you for a confirmation of that, and if so, we're going to go to you immediately. And if not, We'll go to you right after John. KCQWYP. Go right ahead, Skyler. KQRIW on the TechNet.
KC2, Whiskey Yankee Papa. Hi, Dick. Yeah, I guess I'll be going to bed pretty soon, but it's a rather quick question, and I have asked it. I have, you know, gotten responses from other people, including Glenn. But I want your opinion on this one. I just upgraded to General, and I am looking for an HF rig, and I was looking at an all-around rig, such as the Yaesu 897, and Glenn advised me that the receiver on that may not be as good as a rig that's strictly for HF, such as the I2ST450, and I don't want to have to buy filters, so I'm just basically looking for your recommendation on an HF rig. I don't want to spend too much, you know, and, you know, I'm not going to be doing anything crazy, you know, I just want to be able to make some contacts and just basically have fun with it, so, that's all I need, and then we can go back to John or whoever. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Glenn. Congratulations on getting your general class license. Mel and I are a little bit slow to make recommendations that this rig is better than that rig, and it's really not our area of expertise, so I might not have much of an answer for you on this one. However, my best recommendation is that the testimonials of people who you respect, in other words, Glenn, Wesley, Eric, and others, Rich, Joe, John, people who have used various rigs for multiple years, they, after owning a rig for a while, they know all of its idiosyncrasies, they know its quirks, they know its strong points and its weak points. And anybody getting into ham radio has this huge mountain of data to study. There's 40,000 rigs to buy, 40,000 antennas. I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean. Tremendous numbers of transmitters, tremendous numbers of antennas and feed lines and whatever. And you'd like the first choice to be an optimum choice. It doesn't have to be. Even if the first choice is wrong, if you've chosen a rig that has real popularity, if you chose an 897, there are people who like that rig. And particularly if you got a good deal buying one used. And if a year from now you decide that, gee, it's not quite my rig, you could probably sell it and get a significant percentage of your money back to be invested on the next one. But there's another point I want to make. When a person has been in ham radio for a long time, a guy who's already racked up 250 countries, and in the next 6 months he'd like to run that up to 275, in that severe environment where a guy wants the absolute best performance out of a rig because he's getting into pileups where everybody is shouting on top of everybody all at once to try to get that rare new country, that guy has an extremely stiff requirement for the dynamic range, the sensitivity, the selectivity of his particular rig. And so he's got some stiff requirements. You listen to him, and he'll think there's almost no rig in the world that's good enough for his particular requirement. As a person who doesn't have quite that severe requirement, as a new person, you would get significant pleasure out of a rig that has only partial performance. It doesn't have to be the highest one in the world for your first rig. My very first rig was a Heathkit AR3 receiver. By modern-day standards, it was just a little bit better than a crystal set, you know what I mean? I look at that thing today, I don't have the thing anymore, but I look at the manual that I have from it, and I said, how in the world did I settle on that thing? And my first 150 contacts in ham radio, some number like that, was done on that particular terrible receiver. So, as a beginner, your requirements are not that stiff, and it's all correctable. If you can tolerate somebody else's used equipment, I know you always get the best performance out of it. As a person re-entering a new field, you'd like to have brand new equipment where you're the first person to open the plastic package and peel away the scotch tape and so what I mean, and open up the user's manual for the first time. We all desire that. With a little bit more study of the situation, you'll find out that some of those requirements are not real. And even if the rig you're buying has got a dent in the front panel, and that allows you to buy a used rig with a much lower price. You can come out ahead. So, I haven't told you a bet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Without a doubt, I haven't told you what rig to buy or what rig to avoid. And I'm telling you a couple of other things to consider. Continue asking anyone you'd like to talk to what is their recommendation. And in that case, you're going on experience. if a guy has used a 450 for X number of years, and he really loves it except for this one little quirk, which is correctable if you add the so-and-so circuit, now that's a valuable piece of information. And that's a real workhorse of a rig. So you can't go wrong with a 450, is my first impression. But as you can tell, I'm not really making a testimonial. I know I haven't helped you quite the way you'd like, but maybe some of this will help a little bit, Skyler. KC2WYP, K2RIW in the tech now.
KC2WYP with a comment.
Yeah, stand by, Skyler. Mel's been around the block a lot longer than I have with this kind of equipment. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. One of the radios that I've been recommending to a lot of the newcomers, like you say, don't want to spend a lot of money, and also don't want to possibly get something that may be a problem child that they can't handle, is a radio that's somewhat underrated, very reasonably priced, HF rig with DSD. It works wonderfully well. I own one. I have had a number of friends buy them, and so far the feedback has been excellent on how happy they are with that radio. And I'd say to you, look into it, because the price you'll pay for that radio new, you'll most likely have to pay approximately the same price for a secondhand radio, and you will get the so-called pleasure of opening the box and be the first person to handle that radio. And that is the ICOM 718, ICOM 718. Go ahead, Dick.
Good recommendation, Mel. Mel, I'm about to mail a checkoff list to your wife, so that before you go onto the TechNet, you go through the checkoff list and make sure that your rig is in the higher power mode so that we don't hear a little bit of hiss in the background. Sometimes you forget that one. I'm having fun with you, Mel, and to Mel's wife. Alrighty, back to you, Skyler. KC2WYP, and you might need a fill on anything you just heard. Go right ahead and ask for it. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
KC2WYP. Thanks for the information. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was looking at the ICOM 718. I know another kid from Connecticut, Brandon, KB1THM, he also has it. And I know it's, I guess, an older rig, but I have used it before at Field Day. And I made a few contacts. So, I mean, I just, you know, it was on the lower end of, you know, the prices in comparison to a few other rigs, which, of course, doesn't mean it's bad, but I didn't know if it was, you know, if there were things out there that were better that, you know, I really should get and spend the extra few hundred bucks. But now that I heard that one, that's definitely a consideration. It'll save a few hundred dollars. And it'll, you know, before I go ahead and buy a big rig, you know, this will get me somewhere and see if I actually like the hobby, meaning HF. Of course, I like doing this. And I appreciate all the information. And with that, I will pass it back to you, Dick. KC2WYP to K2RIW.
Quick comment. Back to when?
Okay. I heard both John and Paul in that order. And Skyler, come back and ask us more questions as often as you like. We've all been there. We've got empathy for your cause. We know what it's like to be a new guy exposed to beyond many rigs that are available simultaneously. So I'm going to go to John and then Paul in that order for the comments. KC2WGB, go right ahead, John. K2RIW on TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, you may want to talk to N2EO Rich also. That's a great recommendation by Mel, but you can get also more information from Rich and talk to a few people before he makes his investment, but I think he's going to make a good decision there.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that, John. As I said before, choose the people who have got some real experience, whose opinions you trust, and find out each one of them what they've got to say. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick. Now, my comment is about the quality of the repeater tonight. I'm wondering if you were talking about a little hiss with Mel. We're getting shelled out here. I don't know about you with this Connecticut station. It sounds like a Connecticut traffic net. And I'd say with my beam, I could turn it 360 degrees. It's only working within about 10 degrees, and I'm pointing due south. I mean, it might be a band opening or something. I just wanted to